The Bane Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, the wearing away of affecting advertising leads to the tragic fall in cynicism, opening humanity up to alien mind control. Hey, all those cereal ads we watched as kids were good for something, and now they're gone. Plus, we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Larry Correa's Son of the Black Sword, all right now. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bane Senior Editor Tony Daniel. This time we talk with Mercedes Lackey and Rosemary Edgehill about their new novel in the Bedlam's Bard universe, The Waters and the Wild. This is one of those cool books that blends Celtic myth and elves and such with the contemporary world. As a young girl goes to spend a summer vacation at a lake in upstate New York, where things are definitely not at all what they seem, and might be quite deadly. It's a fun conversation about a fun book. And we continue with the audiobook serialization of Larry Correa's great high fantasy novel, Son of the Black Sword. Now here's the news. We have new free fiction at the Bane.com website. This month we have Weeping Willikers, a story by Aaron Michael Ritchie. This is a tale set in the new novel coming out in November from Bane by D.J. Butler of the Witchy Eye series and Aaron Michael Ritchie. That book is called The Cunning Man, and Weeping Willikers will give you a real nice taste of that book. Curses and Prayers. The Eggers family have fallen on hard times, like so many during the Depression. Their farm blown away in the Dust Bowl. They are making their way to a relative's apple orchard in Washington in the hopes of finding work there. For now, they've camped out on a corner of Hiram Woolley's beet farm in Utah. But something more sinister haunts the Eggers family, and when baby Cecil goes missing one day, they'll need more than a place to camp and a basket of beets from Hiram. Good thing Hiram is a cunning man. He's not unacquainted with the supernatural, and he's determined to help the Eggers family find their missing boy. Weeping Willikers by Aaron Michael Ritchie is now available on the front page at Bane.com. and will be perpetually available for free in the ebook collection Free Stories 2019, which is also found there at the Bane.com site in the Bane ebook section, so check it out. Want to welcome Mercedes Lackey and Rosemary Edgehill to the podcast. Hello.
Hello.
Girls.
Hi.
Hi.
Mercedes Lackey, Misty, is the New York Times bestselling author of the Bardic Voices series and Serrated Edge series, both from Bane Books, and the Heralds of Valdemar series, and many more. She's the co-author of contemporary meta-hero SF series The Secret World Chronicle. Among her popular Bane titles are The Fire Rose and The Lark and the Wren, as well as The Shadow of the Lion and Burdens of the Dead with Eric Flint and Dave Freer. She lives in Oklahoma. Rosemary Edgehill is the keeper of the Eddystone Light, corny as Kansas in August. Better explain that. Normal as blueberry pie and only a paper moon. I see, that's a litany of things you are. She was found floating down the Amazon in a hat box, and because criminals are cowardly and superstitious like this from Batman, she became a creature of the night, black terrible. She began her professional career working as a time-traveling vampire killer, and with a successful series, mystery series back in the day, right? And as with vampires, and has never looked back. A woman of many, many talents, she's written more than a dozen novels with Mercedes Lackey. Out now at booksellers everywhere is this wonderful little new entry in the Bedlam's Bard urban fantasy series that's called The Waters and the Wild by Mercedes Lackey and Rosemary Edgehill. I guess there's some that's given away on the there's a lot of mystery in here that we don't want to spoil, but I think we could talk about the milieu pretty well without doing that. But first, let's set up. Yes, that's right. That cover, by the way, was done by Larry Dixon, who is your husband, right, Misty? Yeah, it's very cool. And it's foiled, because Tony loves to use foil on covers. and it flashes at you when you turn it sideways. It looks really cool.
It's got to the point where Larry just expects that Bane is going to foil stuff, and he designs the cover with being foiled in mind.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing we know. If it's one of our best-selling writers, Tony's going to want foil. So Tony being Tony Weisskopf, the publisher here at Bane. So, well, let's talk about The Waters in the Wild. Tell us a little bit. I guess really the best way in is just to tell us who Olivia is and what's going on at the start of the book and what the setup is.
Well, Olivia is a severely depressed teenager who is, of course, in denial about being severely depressed. Rosemary and I both struggled with chronic depression, so we've been there.
Oh, yes.
And her parents are divorcing, and she's going through that whole business of blaming herself for the divorce and then blaming her parents for not being able to get it together. She has really no idea what's actually going on between them, aside from the usual conflicts of people that have grown apart from each other. And she's going to escape from the entire situation by going off to on a family vacation with her boyfriend's family.
Well, y'all really caught that teenage angst feeling of a young woman. I have to say, I was really with her. Just the feeling of everyone's against her, and oh my God, she just like you want something really good to happen to this girl, and something amazing does, right? It's
yes,
I'd which we can't give away.
No.
But she's in California as we start, and where she's going is it's upstate New York, right? Or is it?
It is one of those old, dating back to the late 1800s, Adirondack resorts that has not really substantially updated. And actually, there is a corollary and a parallel to these things in Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana, where I'm from. This is not an Adirondack resort for, I never was in when it was formed, for wealthy people. This is for middle class people. And back in the day when you had no air conditioning and you were stuck in a stifling city, if you had the money, you sent the family to a resort that was close enough to the city that dad could commute out there on the weekends. And you and the family got to spend the summer in more comfortable than being in the middle of the city in the summer. And I actually went to one of these things that had been converted into a Presbyterian kids camp. So I'm real familiar with the architecture and how these things used to run.
So you call it Lake Indoor. Well, it turns out that's short for Lake Endymion, which may give us some ideas. And it is a place that Olivia's boyfriend Blake's family has been going, right, for years.
In fact, their parents probably went to it, and their parents' parents probably went to it.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Blake and his family, and because what is Olivia really just, she's getting some attention from the guy, but he's not anybody but her would see that something's not right with their relationship, right? Including her friend Mia.
Well, Blake of the Lake is basically a spoiled athlete. His father is convinced that he's going to be on the Olympic swim team. His mother, as far as I can tell, spends so much time in the bottom of a bottle, she doesn't really care one way or another. And he gets away with everything that athletes always get away with.
You sound bitter. Is this working out something? I hesitate to ask writers that because, of course, their characters are not based.
Pretty much everybody that is a writer has suffered at the hands of jocks.
So dipping into an archetype here. So Livy goes off with him and decides to do this. What's it like at Lake Endor when she gets there? What's it like with his family? There's a cool girl she meets at a diner, and there's a very uncool girl that's next door. Can you tell us a little bit about the psychodrama of the situation when Livy arrives?
Well, the parents, Blake's parents, are pretty much indifferent to the fact that she's there. As far as they're concerned, she's just Blake's luggage. About the only thing they approve of is the fact that she's not a typical clingy girlfriend, as far as they can tell. They're living in a relatively primitive cabin. There are none of the things that teenagers these days take for granted, like cell phone service. There's no Wi-Fi at that end of the lake. The cabin has basic running water and electricity and not much of the latter. So Livy is pretty much on her own for entertainment. Blake is always off practicing, as far as she knows. The other end of the lake, which is where the town of Endor and the actual resort are, has some basic services as far as internet and cell phone go, but it's all 24 baud over wired. So it's not exactly blazing fast.
I remember those days.
She's basically cut off from everything as far as she's concerned.
Yeah. This seems to be a theme in Mercedes Lackey's tales lately, especially in Silence. The same thing is going on. And in Breaking Silence, there's like...
Well, in Breaking Silence, they finally got cell phone service.
They finally got the cell phone.
And they've got high-speed internet now. But in Silence, no, they didn't have any of that.
So do you think that the lack of internet is a conspiracy of the dark fairies? I mean, I'm just speculating here.
Well, I just think having a lack of internet really throws this into a situation that modern teens are just going to really have to grapple with, and adds an element that makes it to them way more fantastic.
Yeah,
they can't imagine being without internet. They can't imagine being without cell phone service.
It was my son just did a believe it or not. My son just did a book. He met Cody, your co-author on Silence, at Dragon Con, and he loved him. And you know, Cody's a young guy that's playing with my son, and he wrote a book report on Silence just recently. And his big thing was. This big takeaway was that they didn't have internet. How did they live?
That just throws in a real you want to kind of throw your readers to make the suspension of disbelief easier, and that's a real cheap and easy way to do it to a modern teen.
Yeah,
you give them a modern situation, but there's no cell phone and internet.
So things couldn't get worse for Olivia, and then along comes Audrey. Tell us about her, because she's like infinitely worse even than Blake, it seems.
It's not like she chose this life. She didn't know really the repercussions. And yes, she's being a very, very bad person, but in a really strange way, I also see her as being an innocent.
Yeah, well, she's kind of following her nature, right?
Very much
so. Very much so. But nobody gave her all the operating instructions up front.
At the lake, there's this guy named Dylan. And we find out, we get in Dylan's point of view, and we find out pretty quickly that he is not human. Who is he, and what's the magical setup here? And perhaps you can go ahead and say the Celtic words so I don't have to.
Well, he's a Selkie, which is a seal person. And they are in Scottish, Irish, and Welsh tradition, all coastal areas, that they are shapeshifters, and they can shift from human to seal and back again. I've used them before in other things. And they have lately become very popular in fantasy, but I was using them long before they became popular. And he's in a situation where he's been set up as the champion of his people in a fight between among several of the peoples of the sea as to whether or not they're going to go further underhill and away from what we're doing to the environment, or they're going to fight the land dwellers. And the problem is, this is a conflict he can't possibly win, because they've kind of cheated and they've picked somebody that is way more powerful than he is.
So he's
avoiding the conflict by being on the run.
Okay. The overground fairies are the Sega Sith, right? Or the Sitha.
She,
of course, yeah. I know this. Okay. It just has to come
actually,
back.
Actually, yes. The she in general are magical creatures, and they can be underhill or overhill. Underhill is not in our world, and overhill is in our world. And that's just the general term for magical creatures.
Yeah, and the ones on land they feed off human creativity, and you women have written several books about, you know, and that are about the ones that are in that are on land.
Yes, we have.
And they had a battle between them, or some misunderstanding. There's the Selly court.
And the Salish she are the ones that feed on human creativity, and the Unsalish she are the ones that feed on human misery.
But they've generally retreated to Underhill, and they don't show up they're not, like, out in the world as much. But the ones in the ocean thought that they were safe there. But everything got dirty because of us, humans. And how do you... So, what do you call them, the Murchista?
The Murchista? Probably wrong. You'll get letters. Is the good sea folk and the Farage Alt. I had the pronunciations when I did the translation, but that was a long time ago. I just found the style sheet here. But anyway, that's about it.
Yeah. So, and Dylan belongs to the good ones. We know that something bad is coming from the other ones, and he's hiding from them. So, So, talk a little bit about how this fits in. So, how does Olivia become ensnared by all this? This fairy elf drama.
Well, she's been targeted as a victim by Audrey. Audrey has, Audrey has moved, as most, as many serial killers do, and as apex predators do, has moved from killing small things to killing large things to deciding she wants to kill humans and eat them.
Uh-huh.
And yep. The idea of being bringing Olivia here in the first place was Audrey's. She's the one that talked Blake into it because she's planning on a partial to total wholesale slaughter of Blake's family, or at least ruining them. Definitely killing Livy.
Yeah, I'm presuming that she and Blake just talk to each other even during the year, something outside of when they're at the lake. Because if he's got that kind of attachment to her, he's not just going to ignore her for like half the year. So she's had a lot of opportunities to really do bad psychological things to him. And this is the payoff, because this is the year where everybody has graduated high school. They're going to go off to college. They're going to start their adult lives in unimaginable ways.
And Audrey's about ready to graduate to being a full-time monster.
Now, she is she's a Lamia. Is that how you what do they do?
They go back all the way to the Greeks, and they are basically, in this book, we've got them as being basic. If you assume that there are mermaids that are based on several kinds of aquatic life, and her kind is based on carnivorous eels.
Yeah.
In yep. The Greeks, they were more of a ghostly-like creature that would usual nightmare thing that they'd sit on your chest at night and suck the life out of you. And they had snake bottoms rather than eel bottoms, but we decided to go with the eel version.
Why is she? They get cuckooed, right, with humans.
Yes.
Yes.
That's because they are very carnivorous. They are very top predators, and they'll eat their own. So in order to keep the race going, instinctively, there is a brief period after the offspring is spawned when there's enough mother instinct going on that the mother abandons the child on a beach where it will presumably get adopted by humans.
So Audrey did not know she was a Lamia until recently, or has she known all along, or what's the...
It's been a process of discovery for her all her life. It's something actually that, if she didn't eat people, would be something really well known. People of that age are wondering, who am I? What am I going to do in the world? How am I like other people? How am I different? What's going on with me? And she has stranger answers to those questions than most. But I'm still kind of sorry for her, because she did way too good a job.
Well, one of the, it's not funny to her, but one of the funny moments in the book is when she feels this great sense of relief that when she finds out she's like a man-eating monster, that she doesn't have to go to college.
She really didn't.
Yeah. I think that anyone would understand that feeling of relief.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was raised with all of the goals and desires of any other young woman in her social class and surroundings,
and
of course,
yet she had these other desires.
Yeah, and making it all work together was really hard. or impossible. We'd call it that.
Yeah. So this is really just a tragic tale of Audrey's downfall.
But given that background, when she gets the get out of jail free card, yeah, hey.
All right. So all of this is going fine for Audrey until Olivia overhears a conversation between her and Blake. And this is where some of the magic starts with Olivia, because there is a thing about what happens to Selkies when girls cry into water or something like that. Is that correct?
Yes, it's an old legend from the Scottish version, where if a mortal woman sheds 7 tears into water and where that a Selkie uses, a male Selkie, that is, although who knows, there could be lesbian Selkies, I don't know, then the Selkie in question will fall in love with her and will try to protect her and marry her.
Yep. And it was interesting.
Go ahead.
Oh, it was interesting giving that basis where he's basically cast, there's a love spell cast over him and he has no choice. To work to retain his agency and his feelings of being okay with this happening, because of course it's a natural part of his creaturely lifestyle, even though if it were a human who were being forced to be in love with someone that actually at first he's never even seen her, that would be a horrible transgression of agency. So that was a bit of a juggle.
Well, it helped that Olivia's actually kind of a nice girl to be in love with.
Yeah, think of what would happen if it had been Audrey.
Unlikely, however, I can't imagine Audrey ever crying about anything.
Yep.
So what Olivia cries about is she finds out that you know, that Blake and Audrey are not necessarily just friends. And this is all very near the beginning of the book, so we're not really giving too much away about the book. I mean, this is the setup. Dylan, who is the Selkie, he's over at the resort, right? He's a lifeguard over there. Tell us a little bit more about him. And so he's the champion of the underwater elves who has to fight. We know that. He has an interesting relationship with his mother going on and with others of his kind.
Well, everybody's got a big sister that really annoys them, right?
That's a sister, right, yeah.
Basically, his mother is not opposed to him running off because she knows that he can't possibly win that fight, and it will end with his death. So she's not totally opposed to him running off. She's just trying to buy time until they can figure out what to do to either avoid the fight or win it.
Yeah, winning it doesn't look too likely.
What is it that they are going to fight? Is it the thing that's on the cover of the book, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. That's the Faraj Ulk champion. And it's sort of seriously cheating for them to have chosen this particular critter as their champion, because they knew who the merged Yasta champion was going to be, and they didn't pick anything anywhere near the same weight class.
So what else could we say without giving too much more away that Olivia seems to grow into, one of the pleasures of the book is the way that she turns into, you know, an action heroine from this poor downtrodden girl. What brings that about other than just, you know, I mean, Dylan showing up, and maybe talk about the progress of her character a little bit, because I think that's readers, you know, I think that's the thing that would hook, that it hooked me when I was reading it, that's for sure. I'm like, I really like seeing her come out of that downtrodden persona.
Well, the big thing is that getting thrown into this situation where impossible things are happening to her actually kind of provides the shock to the system that sometimes happens with people that are suffering from chronic depression, get similar shocks to the system, like being in a car wreck or having something really positive but incredibly unlikely happen to them. If you get a shock to the system, you can sometimes break yourself out of that depressive cycle, see what's going on, and start dealing with it. I mean, it's certainly not the ideal cure for depression, which is probably a combination, well, not just probably, it's definitely a combination of pharmaceuticals and talk therapy, but it has been known to work, and that's basically what happens to her.
What is some of the magic that we see? What can these elves that y'all have created do? And
I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, some of them are just simply magic in and of themselves. Dylan is a shape changer. That is just about all the magic that he can do. And Audrey is also a shape changer. That's just about all the magic she can do. They can take advantage of the magical portal that's in the bottom of the lake. Their proximity to it can trigger it opening. But then you have the real elves, the High She, which can do just about any kind of magic that you can imagine.
Yeah, and we get a wonderful finale where we witness some of that. So there's a lot of cool magic stuff going on. How does the Waters in the Wild fit into the Bedlam's Bard series? Where are we?
There's no direct connection to the Bedlam's Bard series, except it's all the same universe, and some of the same critters are in it. There is a mention in passing to the Serrated Edge, which is also in the same universe, in that, it's just a mention in passing towards the end of the book. But there's no real direct connection with any of them, except that it's all in the same universe. So it's kind of a standalone book within that universe.
Mm.
It's nice to do that every once in a while.
It gives a gives people a place to enter it without having to catch up with the story so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's definitely a complete novel in itself. But this is the same universe where, like, years ago y'all had the guy that was the busker who was actually an elven prince who was trying to, what's that?
Eric Banyan. No, he's not an elven prince. He's a pure human.
Oh, he's a pure human. Okay.
Yeah.
But they knighted him, and he's never been able to get away from that.
He's kind of stuck with the title.
He was trying to get away in the book, I remember. But that was, as I've read the series over the years, because I was writing all the ad copy for it over time, I was just, it was always one of my favorite things to get one of those too, because it was so much fun to do the ad copy for and such. So what do we have more coming? Are there any other plans? Where are we in this universe? What's going on with from the process writing side of things?
Well, Cody and I have a third silence book that we're going to be working on. Other than that, that's all I know about.
What other projects are you working on right now?
Oh, Christ. I just finished a rewrite of the latest book for Disney. I just turned in the latest Elemental Masters book, which is for Daw. I'm outlining the next Valdemar book. I'm working on the third Silence book, and the Secret World Chronicle gang and I are working on a sequel series because so many kids came into their powers during the invasion and subsequent war with the Masters, that they can't do the usual hero and sidekick setup anymore. So as much of a potential disaster as this could be, they've decided to try making a superhero high school. Yeah,
well, that
hormones
is...
and superpowers. What a great combination. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, that sounds like the Justice League. That's the metahumans, as we were calling them in the series. That's the superhero series set in the strange world where the Nazis come back. And
so it has a trademark on the word superhero, so we can't use that.
Yeah, yeah. Those are cool books. So, well, that's very cool. Rosemary, what are your projects? What should we look for?
That's right. I'm also working with James Mallory on the last of the latest of the Obsidian Mountain books. I almost forgot about that. That's because James has it and he's working on it.
Let's see. What I'm going to be working on next is the Grouse-Starkian the high fantasy with romance.
Rosemary and I are working on Kingdom and Crown, which is kind of,
English Civil War with magic and dogs.
Magic
so
puppies.
Easy. Right, and masked adventurers, because I wanted to do a masked adventurer finally. I got tired of being left out and alone. So
we're kind of doing the student prince meets the Scarlet Pimpernel meets magic puppies.
Yep.
What is your process on creating a book like that? Do you work on outline together? Do you decide what you're going to write separately? How do you do it?
We work out the outline together. And basically what's generally happened is I generally start the thing because I'm pretty good at kickstarting books, not in the finance kickstart sense, but in getting the motor running. What generally happens then is that I write until I get to a place where I feel like I'm kind of stuck, and I pass it over to Rosemary, and she picks it up from there. And when she feels like she's kind of stuck, she passes it back to me, and I pick it up from there. Seems to work out pretty well.
Occasional frantic middle-of-the-night phone calls. I seem to have killed your protagonist. What do I do now?
Yeah, really.
Well, what else, is there anything else we want to say about The Waters and the Wild?
There's a great kaiju fight with jet skis.
Yes, and fireworks.
And fireworks.
It's a MacGyver. Yes, the whole MacGyver part is my absolute favorite.
Yeah, there's all kind of, this mix of sort of that summer camp feel and high elves that is just a wonderful flavor to the book.
The cognitive dissonance is really a lot of the whole Bedlam's Bard over series. Eric Serrated Edge this. Everybody's going along being normal people, and then it'll show up.
Well, the novel is The Waters and the Wild by Mercedes Lackey and Rosemary Edgehill. Misty and Rosemary, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Well, thank you very much for having us. I enjoyed being had.
Yeah.
Now we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correia, Book 1 in the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior. After the War of the Gods, the demons were cast out and fell to the world. Mankind was nearly eradicated by the seemingly unstoppable beasts. Until the gods sent the great hero Ram Rowan to save them, he united the tribes, gave them magic, and drove the demons into the sea. But as centuries passed, the descendants of the great hero grew in number and power. They became tyrannical and cruel, and their religion nothing but an excuse for greed. The people rose up, and the surviving royalty and their priests were made casteless, condemned to live as untouchables. The age of law had begun. Ashok Vidal has been chosen by a powerful ancient weapon to be its bearer. He is a protector, a member of an ancient military order of roving law enforcers. No one is more merciless in rooting out those who secretly practice the old ways as Ashok, but Ashok isn't who he thinks he is. And when he finds himself on the wrong side of the law, the consequences lead to rebellion, war, and perhaps transformation. Now here is the latest entry in Larry Correia's Son of the Black Sword.
Chapter 41. Keita had been awake long before sunup, nervously watching Thera sleep. Though they pretended to be husband and wife when they stayed at inns, they had never shared a bed. Suggesting otherwise was likely to get him knifed, so the keeper of names always insisted upon sleeping on the floor. He was, after all, extremely used to it. It wasn't like Thera to sleep in this long. Normally she was alert and sharpening something by the time Keita stirred, and it wasn't as if someone who'd once been a hard-working butcher was prone to slumbering long past sunrise. Regardless of how poorly she slept, they needed to discuss this new complication. Thera. She immediately snapped awake and pulled a dagger from beneath her pillow. She lowered it when she saw it was only Keita. What? She asked, rubbing her eyes. Then she must have noticed the concerned look on Keita's face. Oceans. Was it the voice again? The keeper of names gave her a sad little smile. I'm afraid so. There's no escaping that damn thing. Then he averted his eyes as Thera climbed out of bed, heedless of his presence, and began throwing her clothing on. The warrior caste didn't get too hung up on modesty. It wasn't as if someone who'd grown up living in crowded, casteless barracks worried about such things either, but looking away seemed the polite thing to do. The message was short. Damn it, damn it, damn it! Thera muttered as she pulled her shirt over her head. What did it say this time? As was required, he'd written it down, but there was no need to get the paper out. He remembered exactly what it said. Here the path is set. Let my general begin his war. The world must remember what has been forgotten. What does that mean? Thera lashed a small knife to the inside of her wrist and hid it beneath a sleeve. Bunch of cryptic nonsense is all. That's it. That was all. Keita lied. He'd written down two more lines, but he couldn't bring himself to tell Thera about it yet. This was not the time to have a crisis of faith, but Keita was afraid to tell her the rest. I've got a bad feeling about this. You should have woken me sooner. Let's grab Ashok and get out of here. There was a commotion outside of their room, and shouting downstairs. Someone ran down the hallway, past their room, and thundered down the stairs. Keita listened closely as the panicked messenger's voice woke the entire inn. Did I hear that right? Keita hadn't been sure himself. I think, he said, there's a riot. The keeper got off the stool, carefully tucking the piece of paper containing the transcribed holy vision into a pocket, and went to the window. The inn was too poor to have glass, so he had to untie a thick cord before he could pull the insulating curtain open. A harsh winter chill rolled into the room as Keita threw open the flimsy shutters. The world was blinding and bright. The early morning sun was reflecting off of every iced-over surface. He'd heard of ice storms, but they didn't have such things where he was from. It was rather impressive in person. Kita lifted one hand to shade his eyes. The people of Jarlang were gathering in the streets as excited runners went from house to house, proclaiming news of some injustice. Workers rushed past below, carrying axes, hammers, and pitchforks. Some fool had begun ringing a bell. In the distance, he could see a much larger group forming. Thera joined him at the window. "Looks more like an angry mob than a proper riot, but workers tend to exaggerate. I scouted around last night. That's the castless quarter they're heading toward. Looks like some poor untouchable slob is about to get executed." He'd personally witnessed that sort of thing a few times over the course of his life. That many angry people meant that the crime had been something serious, and infuriating enough to not wait for a proper judgment. He'd heard of whole castless barracks being burned down with all of their inhabitants inside to avenge the murder of a single worker. The castless quarter was nearly as big as the rest of the village and was kept separate by a wide irrigation ditch spanned by a single bridge. They were agitating about in front of it, but for some reason the mob hadn't crossed that bridge yet. Kita squinted and tried to make out what was going on. There was a lone figure blocking their way. Chapter 42. Ashok stood alone before the angry mob, and Gruvadal still sheathed and hidden beneath his long coat. He held a miner's pick in one hand. The worker he'd taken the pick from was crawling away with a broken elbow. That's what the fool deserved for taking a swing at him. "I warned you," Ashok told him as he tossed the pick onto the ice, before turning his attention back to the assembled villagers of Jarlang. They'd seen him mercilessly incapacitate two strong men so far, and it appeared that nobody wanted to be the next to try. "Leave the untouchables be."
"Stand aside, merchant. They murdered one of ours."
Ashok frowned. He'd not meant to kill any of them. Perhaps the one he'd put into the fence had broken his neck. Either that, or rumors flew faster than truth, and later they'd find that no one had actually died at all, but by that point the quarter would be in flames. "These castlers didn't kill anyone. I'm the one who fought those men." The crowd began to shout, some for him to be arrested, others to have him killed. The local warriors hadn't arrived to restore order yet, and the workers were mad now. The people here were poor and lived a hard life, but they were proud, and the proud didn't take insults well. The roar began to build as those in the back, who hadn't seen how quickly he'd eliminated the last who'd tried to cross the bridge, pushed their way forward. The anger was building. Soon it would overcome sense, and he'd have no choice but to really hurt them. "Turn back. This isn't justice," Ashok shouted to be heard over the rumble.
"You're no judge. Kill him. Break that barefooted outsider's skull."
Their temper was as hot as the morning was cold. Ashok didn't know much about the life of a poor worker village, but an ice storm couldn't be good for their livestock. Life here was harsh enough anyway, but this village had woken up in a bad mood. And the first news they'd heard was that some of their own had been beaten by castless. Of course they were upset, and they were going to take their frustrations out on someone. No matter what, Ashok wasn't going to let them through. Behind him, the castless were either hiding or gathering their meager belongings and fleeing into the terraces. Had his people tried to run when Bedea had sent her warriors to eliminate them? Were they as frightened as these castless were now? Or had they been taken by surprise when Vidal troops had set their barracks on fire and erased everyone he'd ever known? Such thoughts put him in a foul mood.
"Return to your homes."
A miner ran forward and hurled a rock at Ashok's face. Ashok caught the rock in one hand. It stung his palm. The miner had a good arm. But he immediately launched it back twice as fast. The rock struck the worker in the forehead with a sick crack, bounced off, and he collapsed unconscious into the snow. That gave them some pause, but more rocks were being pried off the frozen ground.
Who are you to tell us what to do?
Enough of this nonsense. Who am I? I am Ashok Vadal.
He opened his coat and drew his sword. Somehow the air became even colder. The villagers gasped in fear as the unmistakable black steel seared their eyes.
And the castless are under my protection.
The men of Jarlang began to flee, crashing into each other, slipping and sliding across the ice, trampling their neighbors in order to get away. They were in such a hurry that they left their injured men behind.
That's better,
Ashok muttered as he put the sword away. Despite the mother's predictions of inevitable bloodshed, it seemed that he'd solved this issue without murdering anyone. It was shaping up to be a successful morning.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correa. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com and to podcast theme composer Ruth Jedkowitz. And a chalice of moonlight collected from a fresh spring on the seventh day of the seventh month, which is July. Yep, July. When the wailing woman has been called away for funeral duty in China, and the sippin' is sweet. Plus, thanks, praise, and gratitude to Mercedes Lackey and Rosemary Edgehill, authors of The Waters in the Wild. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.